Regulatory Reform Committee will come to order. Kimberly, please call the roll.
Chair Rommel.
Here.
Vice Chair Joe Lombardo.
Here.
Ranking Democratic Member Escomani.
Here.
Representatives Beltran.
Here.
Daley. Goff Marcil.
Here.
Gregory.
Here.
Grieco.
Here.
Harding.
Here.
Maggard is excused. Mariano.
Here.
McFarland.
Here.
Nixon. Omfroy. Overdorf.
Yes, ma'am.
Placon. Robinson.
Here.
Toledo. A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Let the record reflect the quorum is present. Before we begin, if everybody could just silence anything that makes noise so my vice chair doesn't get angry. We have a few changes this year, and I'd like to recognize my vice chair, Representative G. Lombardo, if you'd like to say anything.
Glad to be here.
Great. And I'd like to recognize that returning ranking member Escomani. It was a tough battle. There was a lot of people fighting for her, but we negotiated a good contract. I got her back for another year. Like to...
It's also a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Great. So we're looking forward to a great year. I have a little bit of bad news to announce. A short time ago, somebody in our staff, Miss Amanda Regis, passed away in September. She was our administrative assistant here. She was, you know, a young gal in her 30s, and she was an awesome, cheerful person, always in a great spirit. She's going to be missed, and we'd like to send our sympathy and blessings to her family. So God bless her family. Members, it's really time to get started. I know we don't have a whole lot of bills, but we're going to do a little refresher of what we implemented last year. We had a total of 22 bills that we passed, from freedom for drinking alcohol, which is something close to me and many of our members, to home-based businesses and a whole bunch of other things. And you know, it's going to be tough to beat that, but we're going to have some folks from DBPPR explaining some of the bills we passed and how they're implemented. Secretary Julie Brown has sent over some folks to explain what they've done. We have Cody McLeod, the Legislative Affairs Director. I know I saw Cody earlier. Stephen Van Bodegen, from the Director of Division of Hotels and Restaurants, and Daniel McGinn, the Deputy Director of Division of Alcohol and Tobacco. Gentlemen, welcome, and the floor is yours. Come on up. And I also like to recognize that Representative Beltran and McFarland have decided to join the committee, too. Again, tough negotiations, but they decided to come aboard.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Stephen Van Bodegen. Thank you for the introduction, Chair. And I'm the Director for the Division of Hotels and Restaurants. It's a pleasure to be with you today to present my overview of the division. The division licenses and inspects a wide array of public lodging and public food service, as well as passenger conveyances, elevators. While traditional restaurants are the largest category of our food licenses, we also have a number of other types we license and inspect. These are primarily categorized by takeouts, caterers, mobile food units, temporary events, and vending machines. Public lodging are categorized as hotels, motels, apartment buildings, and vacation rentals. The vacation rental industry continues to experience significant growth when compared to all other aspects of the public lodging. Passenger conveyance is primarily categorized by elevators, but it also encompasses escalators, wheelchair lifts, and moving walks. The Florida Legislature authorizes the Department of Business and Professional Regulation to license and inspect public food service establishments, public lodging establishments, and elevators. Chapter 509 of the Florida Statutes applies to public lodging and food service establishments. Chapter 399 applies to elevator safety. Administrative rules are divided into five sections: 61C1, 3, 4, and 8, all apply to public food service and lodging. 61C-5 applies to the Division of Elevator Safety. Additionally, the division has adopted the 2017 FDA Food Code as a guiding set of food safety regulations for the restaurant industry in Florida. And that applies to all public food service establishments. On this slide, you'll see our staffing and an overview of our district office locations. So with an operating budget of approximately $28 million, this program is totally fee-supported. The division does not receive any general revenue funds for the operation of the division. We are comprised of three bureau or bureau-level units, a director's office, and two advisory councils, an elevator safety technical council, and a stakeholder-driven 10-member hotel and restaurant advisory council. The division headquarters is in Tallahassee, while the majority of our employees are in the field throughout Florida. And as you can see here, we have many different district offices. Critical missions performed ranges from license and registration processing to sanitation and safety field inspections. Another program strength is our Office of Program Quality. It's not identified separate here. That's in our Bureau of Sanitation and Safety Inspections, which monitors the quality of activity for our food service and lodging inspectors and ensures consistency by delivering at least 20 hours of continuing education to all food and lodging inspectors statewide. The Bureau of Sanitation and Safety Inspections has these seven district offices located throughout the state. They're located in Miami, Margate, Fort Myers, Orlando, Tampa, Jacksonville, and Panama City Beach. Each of the seven district offices are responsible for coordinating daily activities and scheduling the inspections for all of our accounts. Administrative enforcement cases are initiated by district offices to ensure compliance with the law. The division is authorized to assess fines up to $1,000 per violation and to suspend or revoke an operator's license. The Bureau of Field Services administers the division licensing and compliance program, and our Bureau of Elevator Safety has a team of 15. While we're able to manage this bureau with limited number of resources, we're able to do this because annual inspections which are required for the compliance of their license are conducted by private elevator inspection companies. When in comparison to the sanitation and safety inspections, our staff is employed by the state and administered by the state through our seven district offices. In total, the division employs 233 inspectors, 23 field supervisors, 5 trainers to conduct the food and lodging inspections for the state. We also have a team of 10 plans examiners that handle the intake and review of restaurant plans prior to opening and licensure. You may have heard the term risk-based inspection. But if you look at it, what does it exactly mean? Risk-based inspection is an inspection with a focus based on a priority system, because not all violations are equal importance. A risk-based approach allows an inspector to spend more time on the most items that are important and, if not controlled, can very quickly result in foodborne illness or injury to a customer. The Food Code clearly identifies the major risk factors, from food unsafe sources, inadequate cooking, and that also includes cooling, improper hot and food cold holding, poor personal hygiene, so that has a lot to do with hand washing, how you handle food, and contaminated equipment, and that includes cross-contamination, soiled food contact surfaces, and inadequate sanitization of surfaces. Retail food safety managers must implement control measures in their establishment to prevent the occurrence of these risk factors. In other words, they must exert what we call active managerial control in order to monitor those practices and procedures that are likely to lead to the out-of-control risk factors. In order to accommodate the different risks posed by the different processes that occur within the food service establishment, the division has enacted a risk-based frequency program that bases the frequency of the inspections for each establishment on the risk that it poses. So what you see here are the four primary categories that a public food service establishment would fall within for inspection frequency. All public food service establishments must be regulated. Well, they're regulated, but they must be inspected 1 to 4 times a year, and we call those unannounced inspections. So they're They're meant to be unannounced, and they're meant to be a little bit of a surprise. The number of inspections is based on risk factors and includes a type of food utilized, food preparation methods, and inspection and compliance history. Each of these items have proven to have a direct connection to the occurrence of foodborne illness. The following table shows a risk-based categorization, as we see on the slide, of food service establishments utilized by the division. Keep in mind that additional inspections may be conducted in response to a complaint or in order to ensure compliance with a process. And the division reevaluates the risk-based category for establishments as needed. So in summary, it's basic food service establishments that handle food very little. It could be inspected as little as once. More common type of food service establishments where they actually cook their food or cool your food, it's going to be a typical 2 times a year. The 3 times a year are for establishments that have had compliance problems associated with our compliance process. And the final 4th level is associated with confirmed foodborne illnesses associated with the public food service establishment itself. In those particular cases, we spend as much time as we can within the year and an agreeable amount of time to help bring them back into compliance with their food safety needs. Since public lodging inspections are not focused on the science of food safety, the inspection frequency is more straightforward. Hotels, motels, bed and breakfast inns are inspected twice a year. Bed and breakfast inns are sometimes confused with Airbnbs. Airbnbs are primarily the advertising platform for room rentals and vacation rental industry. Non-transient apartments, sometimes called permanent apartments, are leased long-term rentals in complex of buildings. Leases are usually written for 6 months to a year. Vacation rentals, as I mentioned before, is our fastest growing segment of the lodging industry. Should the division receive an actionable complaint associated with a vacation rental, management will assign an inspector to contact the vacation rental operator or owner to arrange for an inspection of the property in question. And here we have a total of primarily all of our accounts right here on one slide. And a little bit of background, our licensure section for the division processes licenses for public lodging and food service establishments and issues elevator certificates of operation. Our staff enters new licenses and changes of ownerships. They reconcile license fees. They resolve licensing problems, and they provide license information to the public and to the division's field staff. They coordinate the division's annual license renewals for over 111,000 public food service and lodging establishments and 58,000 active elevators, escalators, and other vertical conveyances. The division continues to conduct and record over 165,000 inspections annually with mobile technology. Electronic inspections continue to provide a number of benefits, including greatly increased report legibility, improved license education, and standardized violation documentation. For the past fiscal year, the division has met all its legislative performance expectations with a 98% inspection completion of food service, 97% inspection completion for lodging, and a 95% inspection compliance rate for the elevator safety industry. And that concludes my presentation for you today. For your overview for the Division of Hotels and Restaurants, Chair Rommel, I will be happy to take questions at this time, or if we'd like to wait till after our next presentation, I'm certainly just fine with that as well.
Great. Thank you for the presentation. Any questions on the current presentation? Ranking Member Escamani.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you so much for being here. I love these topics because they're just about good government. It's not political. It's just like, how do we be as efficient, effective as possible and keep our people safe and our businesses happy? So I just have a few questions. My first is around the integration with other agencies, because my understanding is that, you know, there's also going to be Department of Health exchanges with some of the food issues. If you're dealing with theme parks, you know, docks, oversights, like the safety of rides and things like that.
Correct.
So I guess I'm curious just what type of, you know, intersection do the staff members work with other agencies in an effort to not exist in silos? Because I assume if there's a health issue with a restaurant, for example, DPR probably wants to know that, and vice versa. If there's an issue with a ride at a theme park, DPR might be aware of that too. So what does that interagency work like? Is there a database where everyone works from? How does that actually like be operationalized?
You're right, Kenny.
Thank you, Chair. The food safety, food regulation within the state is broken up primarily into three, but it's as many as seven different agencies around the state. So the three primary ones are the Department of Business and Professional Regulation, and so we license and inspect really the majority of all restaurants throughout the state, food trucks, caterers, vending machines, pretty much all that you've seen before. The Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services licenses and inspects grocery stores, convenience stores, and other types of food service establishments that concentrate more on a process of service and a packaging of a product and associated with the grocery and that type of retail industry. I think the Department of Agriculture may, I'm not certain who the regulatory authority is for rides and the ride safety itself. While we do have the Division of Elevator Safety, I'm fairly certain the ride program is with another. But the additional agencies, the Florida Department of Health handles institutional food. So I use that term to where you could say schools, prisons, university, the FSU campus, the FAMU campus. Here in town, they're all regulated by the Florida Department of Health and the food activity that's conducted on it. They also handle bars, fraternity organizations, and other of the sorts. So it's further broken down, but those are the three primary categories. The Agency for Healthcare Administration handles the umbrella licensing and regulation for hospitals and that type of healthcare facility settings. The Department of Children and Families handles some of the food safety issues associated with child care facilities. And the Agency for Persons with Disabilities handles some of the food safety issues associated with their group homes or other type of facilities that they service as well. So what we have is a multi-agency meeting that we hold, and we try to bring all the representatives together, and we gather together once every quarter in order to talk about our differing issues, what our current ongoing happenings are, and how we can work them out. But ultimately, that's what we really try to do and what we really try to promote with the other divisions, is that we want to work well together. We understand we're not all on the same agency. But with that being said, that we need to find a way to not duplicate or overlap our regulation, but to make it fair for everybody.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. That's such great insight. Thank you for that. It sounds like a fun meeting for us to be a little bug on the wall and watch too, just how does that exchange between agencies. I just have two more quick questions. When I travel, I notice that in restaurants in other states, they actually post like the gray letter they get from the regulatory agency in a very public fashion. What is the case in Florida? Whenever they get approval from DPR, or if it's, you know, an institutional service from DOH, so they have to post the license somewhere where customers see? What are those rules, if you can maybe align us on that?
So the primary methods of this, so all licenses are to be displayed and available to the public. Often if you don't see it when you go into a restaurant, you can usually ask management and they will show you where most all of their operating permits are. And you might see one there from us. If they're serving alcohol, you would see one from the Division of Alcoholic Beverage and Tobacco, and you would also see, like, probably your business tax receipts, too. So the licensing posting seems to be a fairly common theme. Inspection reports are to be made available to the public upon request. So at one point in time, we used to make people have them printed and sort of available and around to give people a copy. But in getting with the times, we've turned it more into an electronic thing, that everybody tends to have a smartphone now. We have an app. We have a DBPR app that you can pull up inspections on. We have a pretty quick way on our website to pull up the results of inspections so people can see what the frequency is. That's our division department-defined method for the reflection of public food service establishments. So our outreach focuses primarily around trying to get people to understand that that's our method and that we really encourage you to educate yourself on the restaurant and where you want to go and dine, if those type of things are important and critical to you ahead of time. You can go back and you can look at their most inspection. It's what we call a snapshot in time. And for anybody that's been in the restaurant business, one of the things you realize rather quickly is that things can change on a moment's notice. So with that being said, it's a snapshot of our inspection of that particular time when we were there. And next time it'll be a separate time. But that's ultimately our method. So with grading, it's mostly, a lot of it's associated with science. And as a division has gone back and looked at it in several iterations over the years, the biggest piece to get across is the fact that it's not necessarily completely science-based. And part of the problem that just in theory that we try to get across is that, you know, once someone gets an unsatisfactory letter, you know, like let's say you got a B instead of an A or a C instead of an A, how long are you going to be willing to put that up, you know, until you expect a reinspection associated with that type of account too? So there's additional measures and methods that have to come into place as sort of a check and balance if that type of system were to be integrated.
One more.
Thank you so much, Chair. My last question. So this system is funded by fees that the business operator is paying. I'm just, you know, you said it was $28 million, I think, was the total budget. Just out of curiosity, do you feel that you have enough staff to meet the current need of the license holders? Or do you feel like you could do more with more staff? If there was, you know, of course, we don't want to increase fees on people. They have to pay local fees too. But just thinking about that system of being fee-based for the operational budget, do you think that's sustainable? Or do you feel like you need more people to keep up with the growth of businesses in Florida?
Well, one thing that we've seen in thank you, Chair, and that I didn't really discuss in any of the presentations is the industry's growing. You know, albeit vacation rentals seem to be growing the quickest, public food service continues to grow as well. You know, during everything that we've been through over the past, you know, year and a half, 2 years, I think it's slowed down tremendously to a certain extent, but it still continues to grow and it still continues to be there. So I do know that the House and the Senate gave us a substantial amount of extra resources associated with our inspection activities. And the prior to budget years, we were recipients of a total of 45 full-time employees. So I thank all of you for allowing us to have those, in addition to some extra salary rate to help retention with some of our employees as well. So those things continue to work. I think we continue to see a very dynamic and different environment that we're all dealing with right now is associated with business supply chain problems or labor shortages. So I don't think any of us are immune to it. The number of inspectors that we have does seem to match up adequately with the number of accounts that we regulate. So today, I do not have an argument for additional staffing. I appreciate the question. But with the way our division and our accounts grow, I certainly can't sit here and say that it's going to be the same year after year, because those needs will just continue to change.
Great. Thank you for your insight. Representative Oberdorf, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. Back here. Recently, in the last couple of years, we had an issue in Martin County with a hepatitis A breakout, and the Department of Health wasn't necessarily out front in the areas that they found this in, specifically a couple of restaurants that had some breakouts and had employees allegedly that were part of that. So you had stated that as long as there's a confirmed foodborne illness or things along those lines from DOH, that you would continue to inspect those areas. And my question is there really an open communication there, given that now we're into public record? We look at, again, we're back to HEPA issues, things along those lines. So wondering how you're able to overcome the non-obvious nature of names, et cetera, from DOH when you're looking at and then saying that you do the foodborne illness inspections based on them and their information?
Sure. This would be another example of how we work with Department of Health. And when it comes to foodborne illnesses, we have an agreement with them and to which they will investigate foodborne illnesses or complaints that meet a foodborne illness threshold of what they would consider to be upon review of complaint. So when we were to ever to get a complaint of someone, whether it's an ill food employee or whether it's people getting ill, we would get our complaints to the Florida Department of Health and have them look and coordinate accordingly associated with whether it's a foodborne illness, and I want to differentiate that between an ill food worker. So an ill food worker is something and someone that is identified that we would certainly keep confidential. HIPAA laws that are associated with that type of thing are really mostly covered by the Florida Department of Health. So the Florida Department of Health will assist us in identifying that person, going out to the restaurant, making sure that the employee is no longer working, that they are isolated until that they are well again, and that once they're cleared by their medical community, they're allowed to return to work. So in that particular instance, it's kind of a combination of the two. We go in with inspection authority, and Department of Health goes in on the medical foodborne illness related side to make a determination if anything has actually happened or not. So with that being said, while somebody might end up being identified in a restaurant as having hepatitis A, whether or not they actually transmitted it through food or to anybody else would probably be another question.
Representative Beltran, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, sir, for your presentation. You mentioned these inspections as part of your agency's regulatory duties. I just want to have a little more detail on what's going on in these inspections. How long do they take? What are you looking for? Do you have any methods you use to, you know, I assume it's a food service industry, they're open at lunchtime. Do your inspectors come in at lunchtime? Do you try to come during the off times? And what do you do to mitigate any disruption? If you just walk me through a little bit of that, I'd like to hear that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. You know, a little bit of everything. You know what, when we find out restaurants, some operate 24 hours, some operate for only 4 hours a day. You know, it's different all the way around. Mobile food operators tend to be you know, a little more difficult to find sometimes because they're mobile, they're moving around. You know, caterers probably work different schedules because it's associated with their catering contracts. So, you know, we have to be cognizantly aware of the hours that each operator has and try to focus our activity around that. Our inspectors work out of their home. Primarily, they're based out of district offices, but we keep them worked out of their home for efficiency purposes. And so we send them out to do their work for that day. You know, with that being said, you know, I think that we look at a variety of things. In the restaurants, you know, most everything is based on the 2017 food code. Inspections, I would probably say, I don't have an average time for you, but you could probably say an hour to an hour and a half. In a smaller place, it could be substantially a little bit less, maybe 45 minutes. But the principles of what you're checking on a food service inspection are always going to be the same. It's a risk-based inspection, so you have to go through a certain number of violations and a certain number of risk factors or foodborne illness risk factors before you're even allowed to complete the inspection. So I would say about an hour long. They're unannounced. We will often go at lunch. We'll go in the morning. We'll go as people are prepping. We'll go after dinner rush has been done. We try to do it a little bit of all those times. And what we try not to do, though, is to go to someone's restaurant at lunchtime every day or dinner time every time. Just in it, as you were pointing out, you want to be as you want to be as respectful and courteous of other people's operations, but you still need to see what's going on. And quite often, you know, the bulk of what you're seeing and you want to look for in a restaurant inspection is what's going on right there in the kitchen. So with that being said, the inspections are unannounced, and a lot of times we will go in and try to see how the kitchens are operating before the operation actually starts serving their meal, and then sometimes right in the middle of it as well. So it's a mixture. And then our inspectors mix the different type of establishments that they have during the day. So where you have, you see public food service establishments in the risk-based frequency with those. We also do public lodging establishments. So a lot of times they'll do a mixture of the two different types to account for the full day of work.
Great. Representative Robinson.
Thank you, Chair. And to go back to Ranking Member Escamani's line of questioning, I'm just curious. It seems like every week or so I see an article in a paper about an inspection report that had been failed by a particular restaurant. How are those reports generated? I'm assuming they're available for public consumption. I'm assuming they're not, like, released to the media. But how would the media or a person from the public be able to access the results of your inspection reports?
Just go to our website, and you can type in the name of the establishment. You know, obviously, if you were to type up something that was really common, like McDonald's, you know, the result is going to be pretty massive. But if you can, you know, pare down the fields, you know, according to the city you might be in, that type of thing, you should be able to search and locate the establishment there. Mm-hmm. So with that being said, if you locate the establishment, you should be able to pull it up right away, and you can view their most recent inspection, and you can see what violations, if any, they were cited, and what the disposition was. So dispositions are primarily met inspection standards, means everybody did just fine. It's not necessarily a grade. A follow-up inspection is required. So sometimes that's considered to be what we call a warning, but what it means is we saw something significant enough that we need to return to check on it. Food temperatures, or let's say a refrigeration unit out and not holding proper temperature would be a good example of that. And along those lines, probably another final one would be a time extension, or we call them administrative complaints when an establishment's found to be not in compliance.
Thank you. Representative Nixon, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I have one question. Being a previous restaurant owner, so I know you mentioned license education, and I may be thinking about this differently, are there any, like, do you have any type of workshops or anything for folks that are starting to get in the food service industry? Because I know that there are, I see on Facebook and social media all the time, there are some folks that are operating as cottage food folks when they should really be falling under your agency, because they're, in essence, like, kind of offering catered type food. And, you know, folks just don't know, like Representative Escamani was saying, sometimes, you know, you have docs and Department of Health, and it's all these different things that they gotta find to really open the right way. Are there any workshops or any type of education that folks can tap into to make sure they're doing things the correct way?
I'd say most of all of our available resources are online. And so we try to have a robust set of publications and guiding set of information for licensing and inspections. So if anybody really has a question or would like to determine where they fall, they're able to get reflective in that. We also have methods of communication through our email inboxes and through our customer call center and our district offices as well. But what the division doesn't necessarily do is have a training arm in which it, or an outreach arm in which it goes around the state to set up workshops. But a lot of what we've seen is the private industry stepping in to take a lot of those types of duties and activities. So you'll find primarily through two different sets of requirements there, might be familiar to you, a certified food manager. So associated with the management and the people in charge, there's oftentimes training associated with that. There's employee food safety training associated with the regular line employees that can be conducted and given by a food manager. And then a lot of times you have like beverage training that's associated with someone's beverage license. So there's a lot of private companies and individuals that will come out and provide, you know, group training for people and to try to help identify some of those issues. And to try to help coach some of their businesses through it. But for the most part, people that have that kind of need, they will get steered towards us usually, or the Department of Health, who tends to know our role in food safety as well as the Department of Agriculture.
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. And then just kind of piggybacking off of that, just knowing that there are folks that are operating the wrong way, do you have, like, how are people kind of flagged in that way? Do they have to be reported to you? Do you have inspectors that, like, monitor things? Or, like, is there an arm that just, you know, goes after folks that are kind of, like, operating illegally type thing? How does that work?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Typically, all of our inspection areas, all of our licensed accounts associated with food and lodging are in inspection areas. So take a city like Tallahassee. One person might do, the northern side down into the middle of town. Someone else might do the majority of the middle of town. Another person might do south of town, kind of going into Woodville, that type of thing. And so when you get into larger metropolitan areas, they're broken up a little bit like that too. So we often rely on our inspectors because we'll give them this set of accounts. We periodically rotate people around, so things don't get stale. Places stay fresh. They get to see new things. There's always a new set of eyes and that type of thing. But we usually rely on our inspectors in those particular areas to help keep us an eye on unlicensed activity or activity that we see is not necessarily being permissible. And to report it and help handle it from there. But we do rely heavily on the public or on other governmental agencies to help let us know where some of these places are and what they're doing. And along those lines, when you deal with the different internet ideas and Facebook posting pages and things of that nature, it can get a little bit complicating, but nonetheless, it needs to be investigated.
Thank you. I do have a quick question. Earlier mentioned inspections of vacation rentals. Who might call your department to file a complaint about a vacation rental, and when would you trigger an inspection as opposed to a local code enforcement official?
Well, I'd primarily say that, a local code enforcement official, I would think that their primary role in that would be associated with, some type of domestic disturbance, noise-related complaint, long hours, associated with maybe group activities, partying, if you will, whatever else people might be doing at a vacation rental, at off hours in a homeowners association. So those are the type of things that we don't regulate as a state entity that we would look to local code enforcement. Parking would be yet another to help take assistance with. Should we get a complaint and somebody say, man, my room was filthy, my sheets were dirty, there was the bathroom was not clean when we arrived, they can file a complaint with us. We will in turn assign it to an inspector. We contact the management company for the vacation rental or the owner, if that's the person who's managing and renting it, and conduct an inspection there.
Great, thank you. Representative McFarland, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Flipping back to the number of business license, I just had a clarifying question. It looks like there's about 52,000 business licenses for restaurants. Is that each individual restaurant, dwelling, or is it per brand? Like, is every Hooters licensed separately, or is Hooters have one business license across the state?
So every Hooters has their own public food service license. And that would be the same for every McDonald's, every individual chain itself. So, for some that have like as many as 500, 600, 700 restaurants in the state, that's how many licenses that they have too.
Thank you for that presentation. And we can, are you presenting the next one also?
No, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Daniel McGinn, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, welcome, and you're recognized.
Thank you. As I said, my name is Daniel McGinn. I'm currently serving as the Deputy Director for the Division of Alcoholic Beverages and Tobacco. Thank you guys for the opportunity to have Director Von Bodegan and I here to present for you today. This is the general overview of our division. We have three bureaus: licensing, auditing, and enforcement. Generally, you can kind of conceptualize them as licensing are the folks who get you into business, auditing are the folks who make sure you're paying your taxes to the state, or complying with any kind of revenue requirement like you would see in a special food service license. You know, 51% revenue, that's handled by our auditing staff. Enforcement generally enforces the remainder of the rules, regulations, laws that come around. As you can see, their primary duties are conducting compliance inspections, minimum age of purchase surveys, so to make sure they're not selling to underage individuals, and conducting either criminal investigations, working with the department itself, local law enforcement, as well as some other agencies, or administrative investigations that are handled internally from the division. Florida is a licensing state. It's the predominant regulatory model across the country. We license and regulate the distribution and sale of alcoholic beverages and tobacco. There are some states that are control states. If you've ever heard of a state store, they're basically the folks who, the state itself is the retailer at that level, and many times the distributors. We have a tier system. I'm sure anybody who's been around the legislature, a manufacturing tier, a distribution tier, and a vendor tier. This is designed to be in Europe, some other places. You don't have a Budweiser-only shop where they only sell Budweiser. You can go to a bar, restaurant, any other establishment here and be able to buy the items to stop vertical integration, price fixing, things like that, and also to prevent intemperate consumption, which is foundational to most of the beverage laws that you see. Additionally, we do in Florida have a few exceptions to the three-tier system. They're mostly housed in the two statutes we identified. Manufacturers of wine. So a winery is allowed to have up to three licenses to sell as a vendor located on the property of the winery or property contiguous to it. Manufacturers of malt beverages can have no more than eight, and they also have to be on a property consisting of a single complex. They do have the ability to be divided by at least or no more than one public street or highway. The vendor of malt beverages, that's a brew pub. To the general public, that's probably going to look pretty similar to the manufacturer, but it just depends on what your license type was when you applied. If you were a manufacturer first, you go in one way. If you were a vendor who applied for a manufacturing license, then you are a single location, and you can produce no more than 10,000 kegs per year. And just recently, we have had some exceptions come through with craft distilleries. Previously, they were allowed to only do transactions face-to-face, and they were allowed to sell a limited number of bottles and whatnot. But last year, one of the bills we identified opened up some of the provisions for craft distilleries that would be located in destination entertainment venues as defined, and just generally other craft distilleries have had their ability to interact at a retail level broadened. This slide here is a summary, even though it's quite long, of the local government authority. The part to really understand here is each county gets to determine what types of alcoholic beverage sales they will authorize. There's a provisions in the law about what the ballot has to say, how it's conducted, how often you get to conduct it. Currently, there are two counties that are package sale only. There's a Calhoun and Holmes. There are three counties that are considered dry. Those are Liberty, Washington, and Lafayette. They're not dry in the sense that you cannot purchase any alcohol. There's no county in Florida where that is true, so we affectionately refer to them as damp because they can only sell alcoholic beverages below a certain level, so roughly 6.3 ABV. This is an overview of our current licensing structure. Our licenses are categorized by your tier and your business model. The fees are generally set by statute, and they are dependent on whether you're selling for consumption on the premises, consumption off of the premises, package store only, and what type of beverage or tobacco product you're manufacturing or distributing. So you can see we have almost 50,000 or almost 51,000 individual beverage vendors and about 28,000 tobacco retail products dealers. And this year, the nicotine retail dealer is a new license that we've implemented, but we'll get to that later as well. Here we have the quota statutes. Those of you who've been around, again, have probably heard about quota limitations on liquor licenses. Generally, unless there's a special act for the particular county, it's one license for every 7,500 residents. Currently, there are 5,800 quotas, give or take, active in Florida. There's also a number of special licenses that have their own statutory provisions. The example of the most common ones are listed below. Food service establishment, SFS, is probably the most common. You also see clubs, any kind of golf course, civic center, hotels and motels. They all have special licenses that are accepted from the residency requirements or the county resident requirement. Currently, there are 11,800 exceptions to the quota compared to 5,800 current quota licenses. So that's kind of the state of things, how they are. Section 56119 also sets the rules for how to get a quota license. The annual entry period begins in the third Monday in August. You are allowed to have one entry per county, per interested party. So if you're a person, you can enter as an individual. You can also enter as part of a business. You cannot do both in the same county. It's just one, your name's in there once. The period just recently closed. We had 34,000 entries for roughly for the 49 quota beverage licenses this year that are available. And they're in 27 counties. And those licenses become available either through a growth in the county population, as reported to us from OEDR, who I believe takes their population demographic numbers from the University of Florida, or from quota licenses either being revoked or being canceled and returned into the lottery. Right now, we're still sorting through to make sure all the entries are compliant. So the 34,000 numbers, how many we receive timely. Their number will dwindle a little bit because there'll be some folks who did enter twice or something along those lines that may otherwise disqualify them. They may have a job that doesn't allow them to hold the license, but that's all taken care of downstream. So. Once we do have the drawing date, we publish it in the FAR. We give 2 weeks' notice, and we hold the drawing at the department. Last couple of years, we've held it virtually. You've been able to log in to GoToMeeting and see the drawing. We've got the nice little lottery machine that we got from the Department of Lottery. They're kind enough to lend to us, and it's a whole kind of display. It's a fun thing, one of the things we're known for over at the division. This slide here summarizes our compliance activities. Fiscal year 2021, we performed over 56,000 inspections. We have a staff of 188 individuals in our Bureau of Enforcement across 12 district offices when we're fully staffed. About 100 of those positions are sworn law enforcement officers. Our routine compliance inspections resulted in approximately 75% compliance rate. That basically means when we walked in, everything was good. The 75% compliance rate, you know, 25% non-compliant activity may be something as simple as your license wasn't on the wall and we posted an official notice, or it could be something larger. When we issue those kinds of things, we do a follow-up inspection, similarly to Director Von Bodigan's staff. And as long as everything can be brought back into compliance at the time, we can usually keep these businesses out of the administrative complaint system. And if it is something that requires administrative complaint or can't be brought into compliance, we will put them in and give them their 120 rights. Also, in fiscal year 2021, we performed over 2,800 alcoholic beverage compliance surveys to determine whether the licensees were compliant. So what we do is we have our folks go in. We do have investigative aides who we have on a volunteer basis. They go in, they present their ID, their actual state ID. They are not allowed to give a different one or a fake one. It's one that they've got. If they're ever asked their age, they're required to identify themselves as their actual age. If a sale is made, that's considered a positive sale, a positive survey, and you know we take the appropriate action. But in almost 85% of our compliance surveys, these individuals were not sold alcohol once they presented their ID. So you know, we're moving up. It's 83% a couple of years ago, so we're like to be trailing in there, tracking in the right direction. Now we'll get into some of the bills that were passed last year. Senate Bill 46 dealt with craft distilleries. These are the implementation actions that we've taken. We've created a modifier to identify craft distilleries that have vendor license within the destination entertainment venue zones. Destination entertainment venue is defined by law. Currently, there are no applications for this particular type of license, or we have not received any. We created a process to intake the request for craft distilleries to be able to sell at fairs and festivals. That's a new benefit that craft distilleries can undertake. They're allowed to perform basically vendor operations at these locations, similar to wineries. We have had a couple of requests for those to work at local county fairs and some of the other things that we've seen across. I think there's been a couple farmers markets and whatnot that we've seen. We've updated our website for the relevant changes. If you ever go to the division's website, you can see all of our legislative history and the bills that have been passed and how the division's changed over the years. We've reconfigured our electronic data submission system. That's basically our tax input system to allow for these new transactions that craft distillery is allowed to perform. And we've, of course, trained our folks. Senate Bill 148, titled Beverage Law. Most of you probably recognize it as Cocktails to Go. We have a publicly available informational bulletin on our website to determine who can, what you can do, basically what, as a vendor, am I allowed to do? What am I allowed to do as a consumer, and how do I stay out of trouble? We've trained our folks on how to be able to handle these things. Our responsibility as the division is to focus on the conduct of the vendor. We leave the conduct of the individual that made the purchase. Once they get the sale and take it into their car, that becomes a local law enforcement issue. So we're not going to be flagging down people who don't have it in their glove box or whatnot. And we've amended our rules as necessary, or we're working to amend them, to account for the new methods of sale and service. This is an entirely new way to purchase and consume alcohol. So our update, we require updates to our penalty guidelines and some other of our rules to be able to handle this new change. Senate Bill 1080, tobacco nicotine products, affectionately referred to as Tobacco 21. Again, we have a publicly available informational bulletin on this. We created the retail nicotine products dealers permit and updated the tobacco form. It's all in one now, because if you're a retail tobacco dealer, you're also allowed to deal in nicotine products without additional licensure. We updated the required signage, so now it'll say, if you walk into a store, it'll say you have to be 21 to purchase. There used to be a situation where federally they were at 21, statewide they were at 18. We've kind of reconciled that with the bills that your body has passed. Again, we updated training, updated our inspection forms, and amended our rules to account for this and to promulgate the form. And lastly, I believe, is the agency bill. Recently, we require an email address, so we're going to send every one of our licensees a letter that says, please provide us with your email address through the department's online account program. Currently, that notice is available on the website, but we're going to mail it out to everybody to make sure there's notice. We've already mailed all taxpaying licensees information about the mandated use of EDS. Everyone must file their tax reports electronically. We've entered rulemaking in various stages to be able to account for this, updated EDS to handle it, and to modify for the new SFS procedures. Again, the extension for the initial audit, we did hear a lot of agency feedback. Initial 60 days was too much. We were still working to establish a customer base, so it was extended out to 120 days, and we've updated our forms, technology, and trained our team.
Great. We appreciate your presentation. Members, do we have any questions? Representative Toledo.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much for that presentation. Speaking about the Tobacco 21 bill, I saw that you had 28,681 permits. Does that include the new permits that were applied for recently?
We've had one nicotine products dealer's permit come through. It's a location in Jacksonville. The 28,000 are the RTPDs, the tobacco products dealers who are currently out there, either smoke shops or locations like Walmart, Publix, those places where they also are allowed to deal in retail.
You're recognized.
Follow up. Thank you. When do they have to apply for this permit?
Law went into effect October 1st. The interesting thing about the new permit is these locations, if you're thinking of vape shops, were not ever regulated by the department before. So there's going to have to be a period of education where we go out and visit them. We'll take applications with us and say, hey, you need to come into compliance with this licensure requirement. There's no fee involved, so we don't anticipate a lot of pushback. But to find and locate these businesses across the state is going to take a little bit of outreach on our part.
Representative Humphrey.
Thank you very much. Chair. So my question is in reference to the, you said that the licenses for alcohol are based on population, right? With the population changes that we have because we have new census data, how often do you guys get the updates of the population changes? Is it done every 10 years? Hopefully not. How do you handle that? How does the department handle that? Thank you, Chair.
Statutorily, it's described how we handle it. We get the information from ODER, and I believe they get it from UF. The census only comes out every decade. This year would have been the appropriate year for us to get the official numbers, and the other years in between, we work off of estimated growth. However, due to the difficulties in completing the census this year, some counties we have census data, some we do not, and so again, they're just based off the estimates as per the statute. And only certain liquor licenses are impacted. There's no quota requirement if you want to sell just beer or beer and wine.
Representative Beltran.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman. I have a couple questions, if that's all right. I just want to make sure I heard you said something in passing about, I guess, well, I don't know if stings are the right term to use when the guy gets for underage.
Surveys.
I'm sorry, what is it?
Surveys.
Oh, so you call them surveys. So I just want to make sure I understood you correctly, that the kids come in with their actual driver's license. I assume they're 18 to 21, and you hire them for that purpose, and they don't lie, and they show their actual ID that says they're 19, 20, whatever it is, and then you see if the establishment sells mm-hmm. liquor to them or alcohol, and then and I guess you, okay. Second question is, this is, I guess, for my community, maybe I'm naive or sheltered or something. There was a smoke shop, and it opened up in the strip mall that's closest to my house that I could walk to or jog to or, you know, there's a pizza restaurant and a brunch place, and now there's a smoke shop, and I live in what I regard to be a very wholesome, family-friendly community. Is there any kind of restriction from your agency of where they're allowed to open smoke shops? I was kind of disappointed. I'm not the only person in my community. If you could talk to that, and maybe that's something we need to do, but maybe you could shed some light on that, please.
Certainly. At a state level, there are some requirements with alcoholic beverage zoning. You're allowed to be within a certain distance of, I believe it's schools. Locally, they may do churches, some other options, but with tobacco, there's no similar statewide kind of law in place. So if that's something maybe interest your community, I guess something y'all can handle.
Additional question?
Okay, so there's no rule because it's between a school and a church. I mean, okay. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Thank you.
Representative Escamani.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you for this presentation. A few quick questions. Is anyone able to sell or transfer an alcohol license, or once you receive it, that is yours? Just more clarity on you know, how long does the license last, and can it be traded or exchanged?
Sure. Again, it depends on the type of license. For instance, some licenses are not permitted to move, like SFS licenses. If you actually wanted to move your restaurant, you would have to cancel and then reapply. Quota beverage licenses can be transferred freely. There is a transfer fee. There's also a penalty if you transfer it within a certain time period. Otherwise, most licenses either are allowed to transfer freely or they're just restricted from transferring at all.
Okay, follow-up, Chair?
Sure.
Thank you so much. Obviously, it seems like a very competitive process to get one. Is it, just based on your presentation, is it random? 34,000 apply and it's just like a wheel of fortune kind of a thing? And beyond that, you know, if someone lets go of the license, does it go back into the random universe or does it get transferred to someone? Could you kind of walk us through, like, what happens if a business closes? Where does that license go?
Okay, to answer the first question, the drawing is by statute double blind. So what it is there's a initial, the way we do it now, there's initial seed number. That's the lottery portion, if you ever watch it. We pull lottery balls to come up with a particular, I think it's a 9-digit number. We enter that into the software program, which then uses that as the seed number for the algorithm. It ranks everybody per county, and then it says however many licenses are available. So it's closer to slot machine than real Wheel of Fortune, but that's really, it's random. The second question you had for these licenses are renewed annually. And as long as you renew a license, you can kind of keep it in perpetuity. Quota beverage licenses are special in that they have a statutory provision that you have to operate for 210 days, 8 hours a day in any 365-day period. Those licenses, if your business closes, you have an opportunity to, you have a 155-day window, essentially, to sell, transfer, or get back into business. And then after that, you may be subject to administrative action from the state. At that point, we can revoke the license and put it back into the lottery. And if somebody decides to cancel the license, I believe last year we finally amended the statute that if you just don't want to be in the business anymore, you sign it over to the department, puts it back in the lottery.
Okay, excellent. And two more questions, Chair?
Sure. Take a swing at it.
It'll be quick. I'm a big fan of breweries. In District 47, we're home to like 16 breweries at this point. They keep popping up and we love it. If you want to open up a brewery in Florida, could you, maybe this is more off the record, you can talk about it later because it might be too big of a question, but like what's that process and timeline look specifically for a brewery compared to a bar? And I know they operate within a three-tier system, but is it this, what license do they apply for? What's that timeline like for them and how does it relate to other states?
It'd probably be relatively similar to other states. The difference between a brewery and a bar, breweries are also regulated federally. So you would have to, you know, interact with the Tax and Trade Bureau, the TTB, federally, and that licensure process may take longer than ours, maybe shorter. If you come to the window with a brewery license, the same as if you had a consumption on premises license, we'll have to do a premises inspection to make sure you meet what requirements there are for the statutes, but it's kind of a business as usual thing at the division level. Again, it's just the dual regulatory system for manufacturers and distributors may increase the time.
Got it. Okay, and then my final question, Chair, is just around the similar question I asked for our previous speaker around being fee-based. So Tobacco 21 doesn't have the fee, right? It's just a registration form. They don't have to actually pay additional to participate. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I guess my question is, are all your programs also fee-based, and is that equitable for your staffing needs, or is there another conversation about growth and needing, you know, additional support?
For the first question, the nicotine permit is free. The tobacco permit is still $50 a year. You can add the nicotine under, well, if you have a tobacco permit, you're also allowed to sell retail nicotine. Our department is funded through the ABT Trust Fund. It's statutorily at $2 million, sweeps everything to GR that's above that. It's funded through many different areas, fees, taxes. I can give you a breakdown if you'd like. I can send that to you kind of offline to get the, I don't want to get the percentages or the places wrong while I'm at the podium, but to my answer would be similar to Stephen's. The industry is always growing. We're also facing some of the same problems that the alcoholic beverage hospitality industry is facing, be it staffing or anything else. I don't really want to comment on, you know, the secretary's position on whether we need more positions and leave that to a different conversation, but so far, so good. I think we're doing an excellent job. If we're not, please let us know. My email's available at any time, or you can contact Cody. I'd love to hear where we can help.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Representative. Representative Greger, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. You know, I heard lots of terms that were a little surprising to me, and I think really made me want to ask the question why to a bunch of things in this particular section of Florida law. You know, we're talking about in order to get into this market, having to go through a statutorily defined double-blind lottery, an indication that, of course, we know this, that a lot of these items are regulated both at the state level and the federal level, an explanation of 7,500 licenses driven by 7,500 residents per county, but 8,000 exceptions. And we're talking about a section in Florida law that was, you know, clearly these divisions, like the Division of Alcohol, Beverages, and Tobacco, created after the Prohibition in 1935. So lots of questions would start with, why are we regulating this? Why are we doing this? Why does a section of Florida law even exist anymore? But I'll just reduce it to one question, and that is, do you have any sections in 561 that you would recommend repealing as no longer necessary?
You could take a stab at that, but I'm going to take a stab at that. Representative, if you would like to deregulate the liquor industry anymore, if you have a bill slot, you'd be more than happy to file it. And just with the lottery system, to let you know, that is not the only way to get a liquor license. That's kind of, as the population growth, that kind of makes, in some people, think it's fair game for everybody. But there are multiple other ways to get a liquor license in Florida. But if you'd like to deregulate it, more, you have a bill slot, I'd be happy to hear the bill.
Chair, I'm all in. Let's deregulate.
So we'll let you off the hook on that one.
I was going to say, if you'd like to discuss my personal take on the alcoholic beverage industry, I'd be more than happy to sit with you at length and discuss what it is. Publicly, I think that we'll leave the what can be deregulated to your body as opposed to ours. We kind of enforce it the way it is written, and that's our duty.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Robinson, we'll take one more swing at this here.
And actually, it's very similar to Representative Gregory's line of questioning got to, and I'm still stuck on the Wheel of Fortune slot machine type of thing. And by my math, it's a 0.1% chance to win that deal. But I get, there's other ways to get a liquor license. I mean, is Florida unique in either the way we do things in that sense, the lottery, or the threshold that we've established over time?
We may be unique in the way that the drawing occurs, and that's just something where they may have a different system of how you enter the lottery, how you get it. We are not unique in the sense that these types of licenses are limited. I think the chair recognized that there are other ways to get liquor licenses. You can be a restaurant if you've got 2,500 square feet and you sell more than 51% or more food over your alcoholic beverage percentage. What we're talking about with the quota licenses are, they're really a type of license where it doesn't matter about your square footage, it doesn't matter about your sales percentage, it's just, if you just think just in your head, like bar, that's what it is. There are all those other specialty licenses that allow you into the business. And I think most other states are similar. In Florida, we do have kind of a broader base category where we have special food service as opposed to nightclub, dance hall, restaurant. We don't define any of those terms. We just say if you work within this framework, you can get this type of license.
I'll just follow up a little. I'll do in New Jersey. Give you an example. I own a restaurant in New Jersey and one in Florida. In New Jersey, they do a similar thing with, based on population growth, new license will be available, but it's not a lottery system. It's actually a sealed bid. And in New Jersey, the complaint from some people are that the sealed bid always goes to the highest bidder, but it's always a large corporation that will bid $500,000, $2 million just to get that license, which actually in turn some people believe limits the market because it limits competition. So I don't know which way is better or which way is not, but again, this committee is about less regulations, and we're always open to hear better ways to do business in Florida. Well, we appreciate your time. We appreciate you all coming in, and Secretary Brown giving you the few hours that you came here. And thanks for everything. You were informative, great questions. And members, if there's no further business, that concludes our agenda for today. And Representative McFarland says we're adjourned.